Tired of settling for less than the best with your team's dry land program? Swim Strong Dry Land is the answer you've been looking for. With world-class dry land programming for every age group, customized to fit your team's needs, nutritional coaching and education centered on the latest evidence-based research, leadership training and character development to promote an athlete-driven culture, sports psychology education and mental skills training, coaches' corners to promote collaboration, data-driven performance analysis, and an unrivaled family of athletes, coaches, and teams, fast swimming starts here.
Former swimmers looking for a way to give back to the sport in New York City? Reach out to Imagine Swimming. Since 2002, they've been the premier learn to swim school with international and American staff, including Olympic champions Anthony Irvin and Eric Vint. Imagine Swimming offers infant to adult classes, plus competitive team options, water polo, and an artistic swimming club coached by an Olympic silver medalist. With flagship locations across Manhattan and Brooklyn, Imagine is always looking for the next generation of swimmers to pass on their knowledge and passion for swimming. Welcome back to the podcast, Jonty Skinner. How you doing, mate?
All good.
Appreciate this. Thanks for jumping on again. I know that the reason primarily we're doing this is because you're a thought leader in our community in swimming, and we have a group chat, and you add a lot of value to our coaches group that we're in. And just seems like every time there's something going on or there's something to say, you have some really insightful information. So I just said to you, hey, let's jump on a podcast again and catch up, because I just think that there's a lot of people that really respect your opinion on things and just your experience, and just give us an idea of what the landscape is in swimming right now. But where are you at? I see that next to your name, you've got Brain Training for Sport. What's happening with that?
Well, you know, the reality is everything we do comes from up here, right? Mm-hmm. It's all about programming. And even though we see the sport of swimming, you don't maybe say that the sport of swimming is brain driven, but it is. I mean, mm-hmm. when you step on the blocks, you are basically executing, you know, the 100 meter freestyle software or the 400 IM software. And that software is developed and, you know, massaged in day-to-day training. You upgrade it based on your evolution as far as your understanding of the mechanics of each of the strokes or the turns, the start, racing, that kind of stuff. So to me, you know, I always, when I'm working with coaches and I'm working with coaches directly, my biggest point to them is when you go to the pool, you're not training swimmers, you're actually training swimmers' brains. Mm. So you're creating environments, and you want to create environments where the swimmers' brains are challenged. They're being exposed to things that's learning based, so that they can improve and upgrade what it is the athlete is doing. I mean, everyone's trying to get faster every season. You can't exactly do the same thing and expect to get the same result even. So you have to be able to do and be exposing the brain to dynamics that help the brain expand, become more robust, more comfortable with being able to execute at the velocities that you want to execute at. So to me, brain training for sport is just as important in the sport of swimming as in any of the other sports I work with. And I work with sports like soccer and golf as well. And they're heavy, very, very brain-based type things, even though golf swing is very physical, as you might see it as a very physical action, but everything is managed inside the brain. And as you know, we're dealing with two components as far as the brain is concerned. We have the physical side of the brain, which axons, neurons, all those things that are the physical actions of what it is we're doing. And then we're dealing with this whole cognitive thinking mind or the psychology behind really performance as well. And I really like to deal with the physical side. You know, what am I going to do to expose the brain to something that will make it think and say, for example, I worked with kids in Singapore a couple of weeks ago. You know, they're in the water. I'm trying to get them to understand something new. So I basically took a one kilogram weight, a nice little round weight. It was a perfect little weight, you know, with a plastic coating on the outside. And I said, put this weight in your right hand and swim with it. And I want you to start realizing that when you recover that arm, this weight is going to create a dynamic that is very different and new. And what are you going to do with that? And the key here is I wanted them to connect it to what they're doing on the opposite side. So if they're creating pressure on the leveraging action of the arm in the water, can they connect it to what's happening with this 1 kilogram weight on the recovery? And the idea is, if I try to correct things in an athlete by just correcting them inside what they're doing currently, it doesn't work very well, especially with a very mature athlete, someone that's in their 20s. So the only way to really work with them is to put the brain into an environment where they are seeing something new or feeling something new, experiencing something new. And then all of a sudden it jumps out of what it knows, or the brain jumps away from what it knows and says, okay, let's go explore this. Let's go kind of get a sense of what this is about. So by exposing the brain to different dynamics, the brain can say, wow, that's kind of interesting. I really like how that feels. Yeah, and I'm really starting to kind of get a sense. And the athlete themselves say, hey, all of, I can see some momentum coming out of that. And there's all this kinetic energy and I can harness it. And that's a way to kind of bring it into what they know type of thing. And I don't want to spend too much time stuff like that, but the idea is that, and I'm going to come back to what I said earlier, that every coach, when they go to training, is saying, okay, what am I going to expose the brains to today? And if you're just going in there to give them another 2200s or, you know, long sets or just sets that are endurance-based, it's not really challenging the brain physically and mentally. So, but physically in terms of what it's doing to adapt to 2200s, or mentally, psychologically. Oh, you know, I'm sure you loved your 2200s when you were a swimmer, but I'm just saying, you know, the idea is, if you're really going there to really challenge the brain to become more robust, to adapt to the environments you put it in, your athletes are just going to get better.
Yeah. Look, it's why I'm wearing this Sprint Revolution shirt, to be quite honest, you know, Jonty. It's about the mental engagement, and I don't know it to the level you do, right? But what I do understand is that when I was swimming at my best and understanding myself as a professional athlete later in my career, my brain was always active. My brain was always on. I was thinking about every stroke. I was thinking about every push off, every breakout, every dolphin kick. I just had a podcast where I released just recently with Matt Grievers, and Matt was basically saying the same thing. The thing that took him from being a great athlete, but great collegiate athlete, to then becoming an Olympic champion was turning the brain on primarily, is basically what he was saying, is thinking about every stroke and the nuance of the stroke that he was taking. So, and working with a fantastic coach like Rick DeMont, who thinks a lot like you in terms of the art of the performance as well. But I guess that's what we're trying to get at here with this Sprint Revolution. It's not a revolution in terms of saying we're doing things completely different. It's really just activating and turning the brain on and getting swimmers to think. So how then do we encourage coaches to put value on this, right? Like, so you talk about the 2200s, which everybody's always done. We're moving into a world where now we want athletes to really be engaged mentally. So how do we get the coaches to make that shift as well?
It's a good question, because there's a certain level of comfort in terms of control. I can't speak for all coaches, and I think it was easier for me later on in my career to kind of take this point of view. But there are a lot of coaches that don't like to lose control of the narrative, of the environment, of what people do or think or do inside their environment. And they like the control because of what I've found, for two reasons. They're kind of control-based people, or they just don't want to be caught out as sort of a charlatan to some degree. And I think one of the biggest fear a lot of coaches have is that somewhere, people are going to realize they know nothing about the sport. You know, they really don't really know enough about the sport. And I've had coaches, experienced, very well-established, experienced coaches, admit that at the highest level, where you think, wow, that's a pretty strong statement, but that's actually a very real thing. And we can only know what we know, right, Brett? You are the sum of your experiences in life. You're the sum of what you've been exposed to. And the more robust you are as a coach in exposing yourself to things you disagree with or agree with, the better you become. But here's the key. when you allow your athletes to take ownership over what they do, and you create environments where you really ask them to think and engage in what they're doing. So we go back to Matty Grievers, and all of a sudden with Rick was always a thinking kind of guy, and he was always creating environments where he said, okay, do this. What do you think? What do you feel? What's going on? The more you get your athlete to engage with regard to what's happening with their bodies, what's happening with their feel, what's the reaction to the dynamic that you put them in, the better off they're going to be, because they're just expanding their universe with regard to helping themselves becoming better athletes. But towards the end of my career, I realized that where I was learning the most as a coach wasn't from other coaches. It wasn't from books. It wasn't from podcasts, seminars, or conventions. It was listening to what my swimmers had to say. And I think that's that, to me, I learned more from listening to them than I did from any other environment out there. And I think it takes a little courage for coaches to sort of say, okay, I don't know everything. And I think it's fine with not knowing everything. And then allowing your athletes to sort of teach you what it is to them, what they feel like, how they feel, what things are happening to them. Listen to what they say and absorb it into what you know and understand about the way you see the sport. And I've always been a huge fan of creating environments where my athletes become teachers. So you teach your athletes everything you know. And then you say, I want you to become the teachers within the structure within your group. So it's a, if you're in a college team, it's a great environment. But you can also be a club team, you know, with regard to kids that come into the senior group that might be freshmen in high school versus your seniors in high school that are getting ready to leave to go to college. It's that percolation effect is the same. So to me, my upperclassmen were always responsible to teach my underclassmen. And the idea being is that I might give the initial lecture on the performance. Okay, we're doing dive starts today. And I might go through the video and some examples and some rationale and some physiology and some science behind the start. But where athletes really began to understand what it is I was trying to get them to understand is when they might have listened to what I had to say, but they talked to Brett and said, well, Brett, how did you interpret what coach was saying? And Brett would say, well, you know, I didn't even listen to coach. This is what I was thinking. And the kid would be like, ah, that makes absolute sense. I get it now. So to me, when you allow your athletes to become teachers, instead of just having one teacher, you have multiple teachers really kind of dealing with the subject material in different ways or translating it in different ways. And I think that in itself makes your environment more robust. But the bottom line is that I feel like when we put ourselves into environments where we allow athletes to explore and then relate back to us what they get from that exploration, I think we all learn. I think the athletes learn. I think you learn. I think when they take ownership over who they are and what they're about, I think their strength in belief in who they are and what they can do and their conviction about their ultimate performance as an athlete becomes stronger. And I think when you create that relationship dynamic where you've given them ownership and you're listening to them and you are allowing them to not necessarily dictate what they do or dictate how they do what they do, but when they know that you're listening to what they have to say and they can see that you're changing the environment and the dynamics of the training environment based on what you say, what they say, then their relationship with you gets much stronger as well. And I think everyone wins in that type of environment.
John, it's interesting. And yeah, I agree with you. I see this, and I've experienced this myself and probably learn more of that as I've stepped back and kind of observed more programs and talked to people like you as well. But, you know, just you saying that this is the best type of environment, best type of learning that you know, let's just presume there's 1,000 swim programs in America. Let's say there's 800 club programs, and let's say there's 200 college programs. Let's just put it as 1,000. How many of those programs are teaching the way you think is best, like this? How realistically in America right now, how many programs are teaching like this?
I'm probably thinking there's maybe 20%, 20-30%.
Right.
And I think that's probably high.
Yeah, it's pretty generous, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I think.
I still think we're stuck in our old ways of coaching and teaching and in learning even. So I don't know. I see change happening. I see people doing it. Fantastic coaches out there. Don't get me wrong. And I've had more contact with the college side than the club side. So I'm talking about people like Todd DeSorbo. I'm talking about Dave Durden. You know, people at the highest level who I feel like are getting it and understanding it and really connecting with their athletes. But it's still very limited, isn't it?
Yes. But you see, I just think that's part of the system. You know, it's systematic, right? If at the top, if the people at the top are out there saying what's important to us as a community, and the community we're talking about is the United States swimming community, and saying this is the tech, that these are good practices, these are the things that are very successful, and sort of giving us creating a cultural environment that allows coaches to see or interact with or understand how the dynamics work in some of the programs that you talked about, that allows them to listen to see those type of things and then try to incorporate them into what they do and how they do what they do, because everyone is limited based on to the pool size, pool space, athletes, age, all those things. They're changing. But conceptually, I've always been someone that felt like I wasn't in the pool every day coaching. I was in the pool every day teaching. And I spent a lot of time kind of taking opportunity to teach them to understand more so they could teach back to me. Let me give you an example. I'll give you a good example that coaches can relate to. I was working with an athlete a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted them to get a much better understanding of the connection, the body-based connection in that initial part of grabbing hold of a piece of water, say, in the dynamic of freestyle. Mm-hmm. And they were a straight-arm recovery kind of dynamic freestyler. So I had them do a land exercise on land, a dynamic on land, where they took an elbow bridge, in an elbow bridge, and I had a 2-kilogram weight on the deck, and I wanted them to take alternate arms, take that 2-kilogram weight, extend the arm out, hold it, kind of tai chi, and this alternate arms, you know, just feel that connection between that full extension of the hand, right, with the posture and the, you know, the body in line, perfect posture, and just did that for 30 seconds and then got in the water and did basically a couple four cycle sprints, come back, do the tai chi with the weights and the four cycle sprints, so that, you know, perceptively on land, they're creating a very strong dynamic between that fully extended hand and that connection to the core in terms of what they're doing. So that's just putting them into environment. We go land to water, to really create an environment to help the brain fully understand how to be most effective at applying pressure in those points where you create the leveraging position that you want to use to shift that shape forward type of thing. So to me, that type of environment is not, that's a learning environment. That's a exposure environment. It's training, but you're helping the brain understand things and the dynamics that you want to understand, because you're looking for, at the elite level, you're looking for, you know, in some cases, even a 0.1% is a plus, right?
But John, so, the problem with that is that it takes away from yardage, takes away from us swimming up and down the pool as much as we can in 2 hours. So like, how then do we fit in something like this, where you're talking about turning on the brain and teaching and education and communication, and then still getting in the time that we supposedly need to get in the amount of yardage that we need to get in a particular workout?
Well, I mean, you have to find ways to fit it in there. I mean, it has to be part of your training. I mean, you know, if you look at this, I work a lot in the sport of soccer, and soccer loves to come into a training environment, and it takes I brought a lot of what I learned in soccer into swimming. So your warm-up creates what they call a topic, and you might have a topic in the warm-up that you introduce something to the athletes. Maybe it's what we're doing, this pressure, how much pressure, and that feel that I'm having out there. So you introduce the topic, you expose them to the topic, and then you do the topic in what they would call a very small-sided game, or here maybe a short set to where you can kind of put it into a resistance contrast environment. And then maybe towards the end of practice, you put it into the full practice or a set type of thing. But in that dynamic, you're taking what the brain has been exposed to and hopefully learned to incorporate what it is they're going to do later on in terms of a fitness environment type of thing. So you you encompass all the elements of a practice, opportunity for a kid to not only gain fitness, but fitness conditioning, but exposure to new dynamics that make them more either more understanding of what it is they want to do at a high performance level. If they just, you've just come in there, you know, like a lot of kids will do a preset, main set, warm down, done. Right. Well, if you come in, you say, in my preset, I want to expose the brain to X. And they were going to be very conscious in the preset of what X is. And maybe somewhere during their preset, you're really isolating down what X actually is. And they're working it on in isolation. And then you're looking at them in the preset to how they handle it. And then you're on them during the main set as to, okay, what's the dynamic doing? How many strokes are you taking per lap? Can you take one less? What are you doing to take one less? So you're constantly on them on a psychological, mental level to stay engaged with what they're doing in those types of environments. So, you know, it just depends on how coaches approach it. But the bottom line, I think, is that I think as a community, and I think this starts at the USA swimming level, right? As a community, we're not doing the job, I think, to really help coaches be exposed to the type of environments that I think they need to be exposed to. We're successful at this stage because we have pockets of performance around the country that are successful doing what it is they're doing. And we're living and dying on the ability of those pockets to be able to perform. But there's no coordinated effort to make this a type of opportunity as a country to where if we actually take everything that we have, all the opportunity that we have, if we look at, if we compare ourselves to, say, Australia, and we say, well, Australia is probably relative in terms of numbers, in terms of population, maybe not even population, but definitely in population of swimmers. You take the number of swimmers in Australia versus the number of swimmers in California, and you say, how well did California do at the last World Championships? Decent, right? Mainly because the college kids that came from other parts of the country into California, that's where they trained. But generally speaking, at the club level, how well did California do? Not very well compared to what Australia is able to do with a similar number of people. So I feel like as a country, if we get a brain trust engaged as far as our country is concerned and say, let's really, really take it upon ourselves to create a community of thought. And that's a combination of even ASCA and USA Swimming, because ASCA sort of hit a couple stumbles through COVID and stuff like that. And it's just starting to get a little bit of a resurgence again. But there's no streamlined, coordinated effort to help support swimming the way it needs to be supported.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, right? Because I'm fairly close to the situation here in regards to USA Swimming and Australian Swimming, and seeing the results that both countries are having recently. Excuse me, for some reason my printer decided to go off. It's kind of rude of it. I just went to Australia, Jonty, and this is kind of what I'll tell you observationally of what I saw. I went to a couple of programs, Michael Boll, for instance, where one of the best coaches in Australia, and I went down there for a couple of workouts just randomly, walked in at any particular time. It wasn't unannounced, turn up. On the pool deck, I see sports scientists, including physiologists, biomechanics, nutritionists. I see coaches, head coaches, assistant coaches working together. But I see Michael Boll working with an elite group of 12 to 15 athletes, right? Like that's his group. That's his elite group. And that's what he works with every day. And so there's this, and then you go off the pool deck and you go into the gym and you're dealing with people that are specifically there for the strength and conditioning. I mean, elite people, people with degrees and understanding of swimming. And it's not just, oh, here's the football coach kind of thing, and he's going to take you through something that's going to resemble strength, right? Like, so what I'm saying and what I'm seeing is these performance centers that are being built in Australia where everybody has a role around the head coach, but it is it's high-performance focused, and it's elite. And when I go to programs in America, I see college programs at the elite level where there are 70, 75 athletes in the pool, one head coach, assistant coaches running around trying to figure out what's going on, small groups of people doing certain things here and there, but no support at all. And then it's just like, to me, it seems like, okay, well, we'll see you at the trials, and whoever comes out on top is going to be that. That's USA Swimming in a way, right? So it does. It seems like there's a coordinated effort in Australia to not only bring these programs together, but also bring the coaches together. Many times I've spoken to all the coaches in Australia where they say, we get together on a regular basis and share ideas. We share programs. We go back and forward with each other. And it seems like in America, it's almost like this dog eat dog, every man for themselves, kind of like program against program, recruiting against recruiting. Now, I'm not saying that that hasn't had success in the past, but it just seems like Australia has caught on to something that is really going to cause problems for America in the future. That this is just my opinion, by the way.
Well, I know that they had a camp not so long ago where they brought in all the young male sprinters, all the young sprinters, and they brought them in for testing, evaluation, training, interaction, talking, discussion, sharing. And the group was focused on LA. I mean, not Paris. This was a group for LA. And here they are creating a training environment, a cultivation environment, looking at the future, you know, well down the road with regard to performance at the Olympic level. USA Swimming has camps. They've done camps, you know, junior camps, you know, select camps and stuff like that. It's very hodgepodge and mishmash, and it's kind of throwing stuff at the wall. But there's nothing really coordinated at the swimming level, at the national level, as far as USA Swimming is concerned. And I feel like it's a misuse of probably resources. With regard to, you know, you're going to have X amount of resources that you can use to enhance the performance of, say, our kids at the national level. And it's important that we really do everything we can to enhance the performance of the athletes at the national level, because that's your recruiting base. That's really your where your base of your swimming comes from, because when your team does exceptionally well at the Olympic Games, everyone wants to be Michael Phelps, or everyone wants to be Katie Ledecky, or whoever the, you know, the great swimmer is at that year, at that point in time. You know, as your kids are exposed to those kind of dynamics, that's why they choose the sport of swimming. So if you ask my opinion, I don't think that we're allocating the resources at the USA Swimming level in a way that I think truly puts us in a position to enhance all the benefits that our national team could and should be exposed to, and not just at the national team level, but necessarily, just like Australia's, they already look at percolating what's coming in underneath with regard to the next Olympiad already. And I think it's important that those kind of things get done, because the smaller countries, I mean, there's so many smaller countries. I work with the country of Singapore. I spent most of this week looking at and analyzing technique and performance stuff using that EO performance system, Swim Better system. You know, kids are in a pool in Singapore getting tested, filmed, and I'm sitting on my computer in Alabama, USA, and writing reports based on everything that I see of that, just advising, talking to, what they can do, help, that type of stuff. So this is just a smaller country trying to really do whatever it can do to be the best it can be with the athletes that it has. Australia is doing the same thing. Is America doing it or approaching it that way? I don't think so. I think they're missing the mark by 100 miles.
Was it a fluke? The world championship, the previous world champions that just happened, was this just a random event where Australia did end up winning the gold medal tally just by a random chance, by fluke? Was it a down year? Tell me that America's still on top. Tell me that America's still the number one team in the world, John T. Come on. We individualize training in the pool, so why not individualize your nutrition? Erica Biney of Biney Wellness Building will help you and your swimmers get exactly what each athlete needs through genetic testing and personalized nutrition plans. So stop guessing what you should and shouldn't be putting into your body. Athletes within a few weeks have noticed they're recovering faster because they're fueling their body with what they need and staying away from what their body hates. Erica understands swimming. She gets it. She's worked with over 20 Olympians, including the fastest man in the world, Caleb Dressel. Group discounts are available, so go to Biney Wellness Building and get in touch with Erica today. That's Biney, B-E-I-N-E, wellnessbuilding.net.
You know, we're in the same group. And, we're interacting within this group early on in the world championships. And I was one of those people that said, listen, hang on, you know, America's been there before. We've had a bad first day and a bad second day, but we always managed to turn it around and get that ship steaming in the right direction. And then we just barrel right over the top of everyone. But it never happened this time. I mean, by the fourth or fifth day, you realize the writing's really on the wall. Mm. And so is it an anomaly? You know, is this something that, you know, it's just Australia had a high and America had a low, and that was the result? Maybe. But the problem is that if you go back in history and if you go back and look at the historical perspective of USA swimming, and I'm not going to go back too far. Let's just go back into the 1980s. That's 30 years mm-hmm. ago, 30, 40 years ago. The worst world championships we had were in 1986. And then we followed it up with an even worse performance in Seoul in 1988. And that really was the catalyst behind creating an actual, what we call a national team director. Mm. And we were very, very fortunate, I must say, that we actually hired Dennis Pursley to be our first national team director, because I don't know that we would have set ourselves on the path that we did if we didn't hire Dennis at that time, because Dennis is, he's a bulldog when it comes to what his job is. And I think he did a fantastic job of creating the initial environment as far as the national team is concerned and the focus and the emphasis and those types of things. But I felt like that's sort of disappeared to some degree. You know, when Dennis left, we went through a couple of different people. Eventually, Mark came in, and there was, you know, Mark, for a while created training centers and training isolated training centers so to create opportunities for our national team athletes to raise the bar, so to speak. But those frittered away eventually, and eventually he left. Frank came in, and Frank, I love Frank. He's a great guy. I mean, he's a great swimming guy, but he's not a very science-based guy at all. Mm-hmm. He's never been a science-based guy. And I remember standing on the pool deck in Kazan at the World Championships in Kazan, which is 2015. Mm. And we were really struggling performance-wise in the sprint events at that competition. And I was talking to Durden, Marsh, Rocket. I said, why aren't we having sprint camps? Why aren't we bringing all our best sprint coaches and our best sprint athletes into the same location, bringing in the performance specialists are producing kids in Holland, bringing someone from Brisbane that's dealing with all the performance that's coming out of Australia. And let's get this group together. And what is spreading? What is it about? What can we learn? Let's get all that brain trust together and let's just all get better.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen.
No.
Right? It's just not happening that way at all.
No.
And I feel like we're just relying on the luck of the draw. I mean, we're just really relying on the luck of, you know, hoping that Todd gets it done, that Dave gets it done, that, you know, the Florida people get it done. And I just named three, NC State, Texas. You know, if you go into the Carmel Swim Club, if you go into the club level or the, you know, Las Vegas Sandpipers, I mean, there are people out there that are getting the job done individually, you know, in spite of what USA Swimming can do for them, generally speaking. And, you know, that's what we're living on.
How much did you get paid, Jonty, to coach professional athletes when you're at Alabama? How much did you get paid to coach a pro team?
Yeah, I didn't ask my pros to pay me anything.
Exactly. I mean, I kind of already knew the answer. I was setting you up on that one, but that's exactly right, right? Like it's a zero. And so when you're asking for zero, you kind of get zero back. It's like, and then you kind of give zero sometimes. Like, it's like, look, my job is to coach the Alabama swim team and win SEC championships, win national titles. That's what I get paid to do. I'm going to do this on the side because I like you and I like coaching and I like fast swimming and I care about American swimming, but it's kind of going to be my side hustle, right? And that's the way it's approached all throughout America. I mean, you've got Katie Ledecky and Caleb Dressel that you're possibly the two greatest athletes on earth in terms of swimming, and they're a side project for the Florida coaches because they're getting paid to coach the Florida team, which is comprised of somewhere between 30 to 40 athletes on both sides. So you're talking about 80 athletes. That's their job. That's their primary job. And I would imagine they're getting paid zero to coach Katie Ledecky and Caleb Dressel as well. And this is, and again, this is just an example. You could talk about any of these programs. And I've seen Cal up close, and it's not a knock on Dave Durden, but certainly his job is to get that women's team up and going now. He's certainly his job is to continue to get that men's team to continue to win national titles. And then on the side, he's going to try and coach some pro athletes. And this is where the big problem is that you've got countries like Australia who are fully all in on getting these athletes to be the best they can possibly be at the big championship meets like the World Championships, where they go and they dominate the gold medal tally. And then America sits back and says, oh, must have just been a fluke. It must have just happened by chance. And to me, I'm like, are you not seeing this? Like, it makes perfect sense to me in a way.
I might take a little bit of umbrage with some of the stuff you said, because I think college coaches, when they deal with their pro athletes, are really still trying to do the best for their pro athletes. I still think they're trying to create the best environment, training environment for their pro athletes. But sure. I think what falls down is that we're not creating, you know, there was, you know, when a Banchek was still viable and really helping in coaching wise, there were times when he would set up shop at Colorado Springs for a 3-week period and coaches would just send athletes to him and they would go train in his environment for 3 weeks to get that altitude exposure at a good time during the calendar year to kind of create coordinated sort of environments to help our pros become better at being pros. But what we're up against are people that are totally focused on their pros and not just the coaches, but they've got this huge support staff just around them all the time. Mm. And it just doesn't happen in this country. We have no real training centers. They're none at all, really. I mean, we're right. Quasi training centers or your college teams. But
yeah, and I agree with you, Jonty. Like, in fairness to Anthony Nesty and other people that I may have mentioned there in terms of their groups, Anthony Nesty absolutely cares about Caleb Dressel and Kayla Decky and wants the best for them. I think what I'm trying to say is that these guys and girls are completely overworked. I mean, how can you possibly manage a team of 80 kids and a staff of 10 people and then say, I've got all the time and energy in the world for the best swimmer in the world, Katie Ledecky and Caleb Dressel? It's just impossible. You can't possibly have enough time in the day. You can't possibly have enough energy. You can't have enough brain power. These people have kids, they have families. It can't possibly work the way it should work because of the stress that these coaches are under.
Yeah. Well, I get that part about it. And I'm probably going to say, I'm probably going to be a little, I don't know if this is controversial But I said earlier that I don't think we allocate our resources really well. And I realized that in order to get people to run our sport and be the leaders of our sport, we have to get people that know how to do that. But, I mean, I have a hard time believing that we're paying someone $1 million a year, even though that might be competitive within the world of CEOs in amateur sports or, you know, what we might call Olympic sports type of thing. But that seems to me to be excessive. This seems to be, this should be, I don't know, I'd rather hire someone for $500,000 and spend the other money putting a person in Florida and a person in Virginia, North Carolina, and that kind of pod in Texas and California at $100,000 apiece and paid for by USA Swimming, who are experts in supporting the pro athletes in those type of environments, whose total focus is helping those athletes be the best they can be at the Olympic Games, not at the conference championships or the NC2As, but at the Olympic Games or the next major international event on the calendar type of thing. So at least then you get a resource type person in those environments that really takes a lot of workload off people like Anthony and all these people we're talking about to do that. But to me, again, that's allocation of resources. That's a mindset or a focus on what's most important to do the best, to be the best we can be in Paris, because I know how well we perform in Paris is going to be our kind of like message board, you know, to tell all the young kids around the world, you know, I want to be like Mike. You know, I really want to do whatever, you know, if Caleb comes back and makes his comeback and really is able to really do what he can do, because he's a fantastic athlete. There's no question about it. If he can really just stun the world next year, they're going to be, you know, thousands of young boys going like, I want to be the next Caleb Dressel. And all of a sudden your swimming population increases 10-20% after the Olympic Games because of that. And you have to have that. Every world championships, you have to have that infusion of young people that are just coming into the sport because they want to be like someone that they've just witnessed and seen performing at the international stage. I can imagine that if you look at the generations of swimmers in Australia, I mean, everyone that is in really at the big area right now, it's generational with regard to, you know, Susie O'Neill that could have spawned many of the young swimmers that you see out there today, you know, type of thing. It's that connection between the turnover from the kids coming in to, you know, if you look at how much the numbers increased exponentially when Michael Phelps hit his peak, you know, at performance, not necessarily even 2004, but definitely 2008, the bulge that occurred in the next year in terms of the number of people that came to USA Swimming, registered with USA Swimming, was enormous. You know, and as you continue to get that bulge getting bigger and bigger, your base gets bigger and bigger. But, you know, my bottom line is that if we keep putting ourselves in a position where we allow the pods to be successful in isolation, then I think we're not hitting the mark at all as a country.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that. And it's kind of there. And look, I don't see how it improves much for Paris. Now, like you said, you're getting Caleb Dressel, you're getting some athletes back, maybe some of those ones that swam at the World Championships this year who are young, they're maybe a year older. So now we're talking about a little bit of experience, a little bit of maturity. So maybe those 20 silver medals turn into 10 gold medals and maybe it does turn around completely. But I do think, like you said, there are still major things that need to be looked at and analyzed and maybe even questioned and changed in the future based on some of the things we're talking about. Is there anything else that you're noticing around the world? Like China's had this resurgence. What are they doing? I mean, the other smaller countries are having successes as well. You know, it just seems like the world is getting smaller. It seems like information's getting spread out. And it just seems like this... you know, from when I swam and you swam, Jonty, America was held up in high regard. When you walked onto a pool deck, you looked up at America, right? And America looked down on you, and that's just the way it was. And it was a crazy period to be in because America was just this dominating force. And I feel like that shine or whatever that is, that mystique has kind of been taken away a little bit. It's gone, and it just feels like America's another team.
On some levels, yes, I can't disagree with you in what you're saying, but it is a reflection of the world that we live in today, the media, the access of media that we're in today. I mean, the sharing of ideas on platforms that we're both part of one. We're both part of that platform in WhatsApp, which is a huge sharing platform. And there are coaches from all over the world on that platform that are gaining access to thoughts and ideas from the brain trust within that platform. And that was just created by coaches that want to just get better as coaches. And that was just an instinctive reaction to the COVID environment. And I think it's really spawned out to be a really, really successful platform for those coaches that are lucky enough to be inside the platform. But the bottom line is that I think the rest of the world has been able to suck out of America everything that America knows. And really what America truly knows is really just getting as many kids to work as hard as you can possibly can, throw as many eggs as you can at the wall, and realize that you're going to take all the ones that don't break and you're going to take them to the Olympics and perform with them. And they've been very successful at that modus operandi for many, many years, for decades. But the problem is everyone else has learned. And not only have they learned, now they're taking science and performance science and the metrics of performance, and they're really honing in how they're preparing the athletes to be able to have a peak performance at the time that you want that perfect performance to happen. And it's making it much, much harder. There's less really interest necessarily to have to know what the Americans are doing, because everyone really knows what the Americans are doing.
Right.
You know, the key is that, you know, we really need to take the what we know and then really take performance science. And like I said, all these areas related to performance science, and really help our athletes just really find that 1% to improve that performance. Like I said, I mean, I can sit on my terminal in Alabama and work with athletes anywhere in the world with regards to performance because of the way media is today. And other countries are doing that. And I'm not saying I really want to work. I enjoy going and playing golf every day. I enjoy coaching my kids playing soccer every night. I dabble in swimming from time to time. I'm not really buried in it anymore. I don't, like we had our conversation before we start. Most of my creative thought today in the last couple of months has been about the sport of soccer, how to become creative in the sport of soccer, simply because it's front and center in my mind right now. But I'm still at heart, when I watched the World Championships last summer, it was kind of discouraging. And I felt bad for the kids. And and I know people like to bounce back, and I know everyone wants Team USA to bounce back, but we don't. And this is not, I'm not trying to disparage anyone at USA Swimming, but we don't have Dennis Pursley at USA Swimming with that presence of his looking coaches in the eye and saying, "You're going to get it done," type of thing, right? There's not people, there's no one up there like, you know, traveling around the country, getting in people's face. What are we doing? What are we doing? What do you need? What can I do to help you? What can I bring to environment to make it better for you? I don't feel like that's being done. And I have personally, you know, written a letter to Tim to say, listen, we need better, we need more. And he was very patronizing in his answer to me about what he felt like. They were just fine. Nothing needed to be done. Well, that's his opinion, right? But to be honest with you, I know I'm a South African by birth. But I'm an American in terms of my life. The majority of my life has been spent kind of working for this country, and actually working for this country at different periods in my life. And I'm a patriot at heart. I mean, I'm all red, white, and blue. And everything breaks loose in Paris next year, I'm all red, white, and blue. I had to say that, you know, the green and gold, it's there, but I'm really red, white, and blue front and center.
And well, I mean, this country was built on immigrants, right? I mean, if you look at the history of the U.S., it's built on immigrants. So it's not to say that the people that were born here haven't had a major effect on the country, but you know, you can't take away the history of America and the people that have come to this country and been given a second lease of life and invested just as much of their life into the country and believe in the red, white, and blue, like you said, and would fight for it, die for it, and believe in it. So I don't think there's any question of where you came from in the past and who you are now. I think everybody knows that, you know, you spend a lifetime in America and helping Americans. And so that's there. I don't think that needs to be said. But one thing that came up, which was very new and quite shocking, I thought, and should be talked about in a way, because I think it may come up again in the future, and it may, and was certainly a talking point amongst us, right? Like, there's always been a situation where American coaches have coached foreign athletes. That's always been there. You know, it's just part of the recruiting process. You recruit foreign athletes like myself, who came from Australia, came to Auburn University, swam for David Marsh, went back, swam for Australia, and David was always a fan and supporter of mine. But, you know, we had a situation this year where the head coach of the American team was outwardly promoting the success of a foreign athlete while they were the head coach of the U.S. team, which I found to be quite shocking and new. Now, again, it's not new to coach an athlete, but it's always been the case of when you're at the meet and you're representing a certain country, that's who you're with. Now Bob Bowman, who I love, Bob Bowman, and I think this is where it's been mixed up in some regards. It wasn't an attack on Bob Bowman. It was an attack on kind of what was happening in a way. I was very shocked by the fact that he was tweeting and reposting and bragging about his foreign athlete while he was the head coach of America. And again, like I said, it happened, and it happened every day of the meet while America was getting beat up. So it had to have some effect on the kids on the team, because they see this stuff. They know this stuff. They're in tune with social media. So the head coach is tweeting about a French athlete. I mean, I would be pissed off, but that's just me. But then it may happen again, right? It could happen again. So, like, what's your thoughts on it and how it evolved and how it was handled or not handled and things like that?
Okay, so I'm not privy to anything that happened this time. I couldn't tell you what's going on in the back room. I don't have a line into the back room. I just know that for many years, especially when Dennis was in charge, that, you know, when you signed on to be a coach, you were not allowed to really interact with your athletes at all. You were not allowed to interact with your foreign athletes. You were there at that meet to coach the Team USA, and that was it. And, I mean, coaches kind of snuck off on the side once in a while, and they got a little interaction, but they were really careful about not kind of putting themselves in a position where they were seen as being coaching other kids. And I think that's important. I don't think that you're on Team USA. I don't think you're on Team USA staff, right, without really signing on to the fact that you're all in for Team USA. And, you know, if there's little bits and pieces here, fine. That's it. So what happened last summer, I completely disagree with. And again, I've known Bob for a long time. And, you know, I can certainly understand where Bob was coming from. And I don't think necessarily Bob wasn't doing anything that Bob didn't want to do. But the buck stops at who's in charge of Bob. You know, who's Bob's boss?
Right?
Who's managing that side of things? And I think that's where the problem is. I think we need strength in leadership. And again, it's hard because, I haven't interacted at all with Lindsay. I've interacted with Tim. And my intimation has been that we need a lot more coordination strength coming from those types of positions. Because I just think that, you know, to last summer was embarrassing. And I hate this, and I'll say it publicly, I'm sorry, Bob, but it was embarrassing. And I don't think it should have been handled that way at all.
Listen, it's hard to disagree. I was very fired up about it myself in terms of, look, I've gone and been at these world championships and had other athletes that I've had to deal with for sure and talk to, but I just thought that was just really out of line, and especially coming from the head coach, right? Like, it's just it was and the head coach that is getting
any beaten. Coach, Red, it didn't it didn't it just it's worse if it's the head coach. It doesn't matter. If you're a coach on the team, then you should be held to a certain set of standards. Right. And one of those standards is that stuff doesn't happen at all. Right. You know, when the meet's over, you can do that to your heart's content. You know, when you're back home, it's kind of like the drinking, you know, the whatever rule. When you sign on, no alcohol until you're back home, you step foot off that plane, you're completely released. Go get blitzed if you want, fine, right? But,
Well, this might be part of the bigger problem, too, is you know, when I talk to the Australian coaches, they say they're very connected, they're very together. Everybody is fighting for Australia. They go, they walk home together between the meets. They go and have a soft drink together. They go and eat together. They go and everything they do, they move together, they think together, they share together. And what I had heard, and again, I'm not on the inside either here, Jonty, but I'd heard, and I would imagine the pressure that these coaches are under in terms of recruiting and performance for their own programs back home. You know, it used to be a situation where you would have a head coach who was in a job for 15, 20 years, you know, and they were very secure. We're not in that environment anymore, Jonty, where everybody's under pressure. Everybody's being questioned. If you don't have results within 3 or 4 year period, you could be out the door. So we're seeing extreme amount of pressure on these coaches like Bob to have athletes perform at this championship and to then brag about the success so they can recruit other athletes to come to that program and feed the cycle. So again, it's not a, you know, we're not looking at Bob and saying Bob did a bad thing necessarily, but is just Bob part of the bigger picture that it has issues with it, don't you think?
Well, Brett, what's wrong with like some other coach at ASU that's not connected to Team USA? And I couldn't tell you that even Rachel, because Rachel wasn't necessarily connected to any teams. I don't know if she was on deck with another team. She might have been on deck with another team. But someone else could have taken that mantle very easily. Someone else could have been the person that was putting that out, right? Someone else can handle that role. Doesn't necessarily have to be Bob taking that role. You can still get the job done without really, to some degree, I think, denigrating the role that you're in at that point in time. And again, I don't necessarily feel like it happened because there was – I mean, I can't imagine, you don't know Dennis personally as well as I know Dennis, but I just don't see it happening on Dennis's watch. It would never happen on Dennis's watch.
Yeah, no, I do know him well enough to know that wouldn't happen for sure. And it does seem like there's this lack of leadership there, right? Like we have a named head coach, but there's no overseer, is there? Like who's checking Bob, like you said?
I don't know, but I just feel like I just see Dennis's nostrils flaring and his arms coming up off his side and just getting all fired up about stuff like that. And then that's part of what I wrote to Tim about. I said, I don't want to disparage the circumstances because people are in the position they're in right now because of decisions made many years ago. And no one's willing to sit down and say, what do we need to do? Look forward. You know, LA, what's going to be beyond LA? What do we need to put in place to be most successful, you know, 5 years down the road, you know, 9 years down the road? And is that being done? I mean, I don't know. I one would hope so. I certainly hope they are.
How do you then get support?
I don't get a sense of it.
Huh? How do you get support for a guy like, you know, any one of these, you know, Anthony's the head coach of the men's team next year, right? Like, so how do you get support for everybody to rally around Anthony and say, we're going to make this men's team the best American men's team we can possibly make it because we're all going to rally around Anthony as the head coach and support him. And yet we're all fighting against each other to have the best programs in the college system. So how do you drop all that and then say, we're going to put Team USA first? Like in reality, is it even possible?
You know, to be honest with you, in all the teams, and work at USA Swimming, which was basically a period from 2000 through 2008, and there was quite a number of world championships and Olympic games that I participated in. I still felt like when the team came together, at the team venue, usually after the trials and the camp and the preparation camp. There was, I don't remember a team really not having a lot of camaraderie, really developing it in that type of environment. I feel like, you know, Frank's team from when Franklin was really at their peak at that point in time, they were still doing things that really created a really, really strong team dynamic type of thing. So the opportunity, they've been able to do that. I think people have been able to get together and do that in a very acute environment, which is post-Olympic trials all the way into the games, that 3 to 4, 4 to 5 week period to really focus really hard on that. But then you had to be completely focused on Team USA. And if you go into the environment like the World Championships and you've said all these things and, you know, given lip service to all these things that we're going to do, and then you do what happened at the last World Championships, that just undermines everything. So I just feel
if you've got no leadership, right, like at the top end, you've got no leadership at the top end, and then you've got these new pressures, like I'm saying, you know, coaches are now given 3 or 4 years to have success, let's say. So that has shifted too, Jonty, from 15, 20 years ago, where coaches were a little bit more comfortable. Maybe they didn't have the social media side. And maybe it wasn't about who could brag the most about who has the best, you know, team and who has the best individuals. And they're constantly on social media telling everybody how great they are. So that has shifted too. So if you don't have the leadership and then you have these pressures, is it just going to continue to get worse? Is basically what I'm thinking and saying.
Hey guys, I've been trialing some revolutionary new swim tech. And now you can get your hands on it too. This is EO Swim Better, a swimming evolution in the palm of your hands. Improve your technique with EO Swim Better.
Analyze your stroke technique with EO's Swim Better handset. Go to eolab.com, use code Brett at checkout and save 10%.
Yeah, outside of, you know, leadership being leadership from the head office at USA Swimming versus leadership right. of the announced team leaders for the games. And, when you looked at the dynamic that I go back to the Dennis period because I think that was the best period we had. I think when he was here and Jim Young was president of USA Swimming and also a coach, we really had, I think, a lot of good things going because we had a really dynamic coach who was the president. We had an ex-dynamic coach who was the, you know, the national team director type of thing. And I think we had a lot of focus on helping USA Swimming become the best we could possibly be, giving us the best tools to get there type of thing. And I felt like it's disappeared after that. I think after it kind of slowly disappeared and dissipated after since probably 2008, and even more so since Frank left the program. So I don't feel like it's at the same level that it could have, should have been. And the system that we have in place, it seems like everyone has these people in their system that are, they might not be a head coach per se, and how we pick them, you know, men's and women's head coaches, but someone that's traveling around the country that's right in all the different locations, interacting with them, talking to them, what do we need to do, meeting with Anthony in-house on a regular basis, what can we put in place to support him? Because, you know, he doesn't necessarily have to do anything for USA Swimming, really, to be honest with you. It all gets done by the manager. Or the managers, because there's going to be a head manager and a couple managers underneath that manager. And they're really responsible, along with USA Swimming, to create the structure that's going to be our preparation for Paris. I mean, Anthony doesn't have to really step into the breach until the team is selected. But there's a lot of stuff going on that I think can be helped if there are people meeting with him on a regular basis. And then if he has someone on his deck that that's paid for by USA Swimming that helps his program become a better program, specifically with the pros that are getting, you know, that are most important getting ready. And, you know, maybe have someone on the deck out in Virginia, although Virginia has a really good non-USA Swimming practitioner that supports that program very well in that environment. But, you know, if we don't have these people supporting some of the people like the head coaches to make sure that they're not overstress and overwork so that they actually get to that final run of the last 3 to 4 or 5 weeks. So they're somewhat rested and ready to have the resiliency, the energy, and the tenacity to take that team and just say, hey, probably the best speech, probably one of the best speech I ever watched at the Olympic Games was in 2000. And it was the team meeting that we had the night before the Olympics started, and everyone got in a room, and, you know, the coaches spoke. We didn't have necessarily a very good first day per se relative to the results, but that just fueled the catalyst. I mean, people just came back the next day and just wanted to just, you know, whatever happened there, there was an aberration. And you know how that meet went. Mm. But I remember there was in that meeting, and Mark Schubert kind of finished that meeting. He was the last person to speak. And I don't know where he got this device or this tool, but he gave a real good impassioned speech to the team. So I remember feeling, I'm feeling pretty good. And he said, and he poured this, took this urn. He had this big urn, and he said, you know, we're going to be able to give a whole bunch. And he poured some water. He tipped this urn up completely upside down, and he put it back on the table. And he said, you know, we're going to need to find some more. And he took that urn and he turned it over again, and some more water came out of it into the receptacle he was pouring it into. It. And people were like, well, that's pretty cool. You know, there was kind of some novelty to what he had actually done. And he looked everyone in the eye and he said, you know what? We might actually really have to dig down deep and find something more. And he turned that thing over again, and more water came out of it. And where it came from, I don't know. Whatever trick, you know, smoke and mirrors. But I guarantee you, every one of us walked out that room, man, we would have punched hole in walls because we were so energized for Team USA at that point in time. And I was just a sports science guy, but I was walking out that room going, okay, bring it on, baby. I'm ready. You know, I can imagine the kids are just out of their gourd. You know, type of thing.
Well, it'll be interesting, you know. It'll be interesting to see how this develops. You know, either the USA come back in Paris and they finish on top and have another successful campaign and nothing changes, or they get beat up a little bit and either win by a little bit or don't win the medal count, the gold medal count again, and we may see some major changes. So it'll be interesting. I think there's a lot of pressure on a lot of people over the next kind of 8 months to see what kind of how this all shakes out. I can tell you this, the Australians, from just the Australian point of view, are extremely focused on matching their performance from the World Championships. There's no doubt in my mind that they want to go back and have the same Paris Olympics that they did World Championships this year, and everybody is completely focused on that. So that will be interesting. They're up for a fight. I know that, like I said, China's really strong right now. The smaller countries, the European countries, have got their bits and pieces here and there, and they're going to compete. So cumulatively, put it all together, it's going to be a very competitive year. Great Britain, oh my God, Great Britain look incredible. They got the 200 freestylers for men right now. They got like four of the top six guys in the world. That's incredible. The Australian women have like 10 girls that can go under 53.
Guys that didn't even know their names a couple of years ago. You know what I'm saying? There are a couple of people. So, I mean, the pool is huge right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And so it's too bad. We should need to start the meet tomorrow so we can just get into it. But we can't. We have to wait for it. But I hope, I'm not the kind of person that says, I hope we fall flat on our face so we can really sit down and have a real, you know, meeting and say, listen, let's solve this. You know, 1986 and 1988 changed the landscape in USA swimming for the better. And we made good decisions because we had poor performances at the world level. And so we made good changes. And I hate to really, it come to something like that for USA swimming to actually make a change. Now we should be able to make the change regardless of whether we come back and punch Australia in the mouth and they can't handle it next year. Right?
Yep.
We should be able to make changes regardless, because we're looking at the future and we recognize what the playing field looked like. And the elephant in the room that no one ever talks about is where AI is going to fit into all of this.
Mm.
And how AI is going to impact everything and anything we do. You know, and if we're not looking at AI we're not sitting in a room saying, where is AI? How's it going to impact our sport? And what are we going to do to harness it type of thing? Then we're going to, we're going to be a generation behind the people that do.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, AI is surging, taking over the world in a way. And I think people are being left behind if they're not on top of it right now. There's one more topic that I really want to talk about with you before I let you go here is kind of the health and well-being. You know, like we're talking about mental health a lot. We're seeing athletes openly talk about the fact that they're struggling at times. You know, all swimmers are going to have that effect of like a real high when they go to a championship and major lows when they come off and things like that. That's always been there. It's been normal. But we're seeing more of it now where athletes are really questioning what they're doing, how they're doing it, how long they're doing it for. Swimming used to be a situation where you had to do doubles, right? It was just you swam doubles every day. That was just the way it was. A lot of athletes have gone into this, you know, singles type, you know, format now where they're swimming once a day and trying to manage their health and well-being a little bit longer. So in terms of just what you're seeing and the way sport is evolving, is there anything that you're picking up on?
You know, there's a couple things. There have been circumstances recently in our sport and in gymnastics where athletes at the peak level of their games have basically withdrawn, essentially.
Mm. Right.
And I don't know if that's a Pandora's box. I don't know if that's created a Pandora's box where people start to think that it's okay and it's acceptable to do that. I think time will only tell. But we're also dealing with a media crush of attention and focus that no one's ever had to deal with before at the level that people have to deal with. And you can't isolate yourself away from it. I mean, you can. You have to sort of go live in mountain somewhere with no connection and no connectivity whatsoever, but that's not feasible as far as preparation for this sport. But I'm concerned a little bit about that Pandora's box. But you know, when we had the COVID thing, what was most interesting from the COVID period was that the perception was that people were going to lose conditioning and lose training and lose performance and all those things. And what happened? It was the exact opposite. Everyone came out of that time off period where there was no training or no formalized training or intense training type of thing. And in a very short period of time, we're able to perform at a level and in higher level than they ever had before. And I thought that was very eye-opening. I thought that was very interesting because what caused that? You know, what led to that? I think on probably the, you know, the thing that was probably the most prominent thing that led to that was the psychological, the mental, this level right up here. Mm. Because I was lucky enough, Jason Lezak called me up and said, listen, we need some help. Can you help coach the Cali Condors and the ISL?
Mm.
And so I said, yes, it was a great experience. I loved it. It was a lot of fun, except someone poking a freaking thing up my nose every week. I got sick and tired of those people. But, you know, one of the most interesting things is that early on, you know, the first meeting we had as a team, Caleb has a fantastic presence in a room with people. And I don't want to, it's a PG audience, but he said, he said it very differently, but he said, I am seriously hungry for competition.
Mm.
Right? He was so into being able to compete and get out there and play and race and get after it type of thing. Right. And I think that said a lot. And it wasn't created because he created that out of his own. It was created by some other circumstance putting us in that position. But what I would like coaches to understand, what did we learn from that? What did you learn from that? And what can you take in that learning and apply to what we do in the future? You know, I'm really, really interested to see the resurgence that he is. I'm probably as big a fan probably has to see what he can do because I think he's a fantastic human being. I mean, he is one of life's good guys. He really is. Mm. to see if he finds that hunger. And then not just, I know he has the hunger. There's no question that he has the hunger. Physically, can he get it back and sharpen it up and hone it up so he's ready to go? Because if that guy is hungry and ready to go, dangerous animal. Don't want to face him in a dark corner.
Right. Yeah. There's no doubt about that. Well,
now the bottom line I'm trying to say is, you know, just learn from these experiences that we've had as a sport, you know, the environments have been put into as a sport, and just don't rush headlong and just train and just sit down and think about the health, the well-being, and what can they, and sit down in a room with your athletes. And I know Greg was great doing this. Greg Troy was doing with Lochte, some of the people he coached, where he would give them complete time off and away from the sport. I mean, he'd give them months away from the sport with the, you know, the deal was that you could be away, but when you come back, it's going to be all, you know, it's full on type of thing. But at least he recognized the need to get away and not train and do something else and be someone else type of thing, maybe type of thing. So I'm not sure it's germane to, but maybe, you know, what we've been talking about, the health of the well-being of the health thing is the most important thing. And if we can avoid getting to the Olympic Games where, you know, your top star gymnast just says, I'm done. I'm fried. I'm done. I can't handle it anymore. You know, your top sprinter just says, I'm just dead. I'm tired. I'm just physically, you know, that's it. I can't handle this environment anymore. We need to figure out ways to avoid getting to that point, because we just don't want to get there to begin with. And if we're smart about what we're doing day to day, I think we can avoid it.
Well, the bottom line is we do want that for our athletes, but we also need to recognize that in our coaches too. We need to support each other.
I agree. The first thing I did with Todd when I heard he did not go to the World Championships is text him and say, smart move, bud. I agree with you 100%. Not going to that meet is a really smart move to regenerate yourself for next year. Right. I don't know if a lot of other people did that, but I did that.
Yeah, no, it's smart. And look, I think you're right. These coaches groups that we have are important. The way that we support each other, challenge each other. You know, it gets fun at times, which I like. You know, at the underlying you know, cloth of both you and I is there's an Australian in there and there's a South African in there, so we have a little bit of fun sometimes with each other. And maybe the Americans, the pure Americans, don't understand that at times, but it's all respect, it's all love. But mate, I love this. I appreciate you doing this today. This is really cool. And yeah, there's a lot to think about and learn. And it's going to be a good year of swimming. I think it's going to be some fast swimming this year, and yeah, it'd be really cool. All right, thanks, Jonty, appreciate it, mate.
All right, take care, buddy.